What up, what up, what up? This is your host, J-Mac, and this is the Mac Attack Show. I'm excited, delighted, and a whole lot of other eds to bring to you this new podcast that deals with topics like faith, love, marriage, dating, justice, finances, health, whatever you want to talk about. We're going to talk about it here on the Mac Attack Show. And so I'm looking forward to hearing from you. We'll be beating the street. We'll be doing interviews and we'll upload to YouTube. We'll be getting conversations. We'll even have special guests, whether we're talking about education, whether we're talking about current events, whether we're talking about movies, hip hop albums, sports, whatever's going on. That's what we're going to talk about here on the Mac Attack Show. And so we want you to send us your emails at jmacattackshow.com. Follow us on Twitter, Instagram, Snapchat, and we want to present to you the most sound current events with great facts as well as funny and interesting opinions. We look forward to hearing from you. We look forward to talking to you because this is a show for the people and by the people. And so tune in to SoundCloud next month as this is just the introduction, but we want you to get ready for the Mac Attack Show. This is your host, J Mac. I love you. Stay blessed. That's right. Here we go. Welcome to the Mac Attack Show. This is the February edition in which we recognize several important factors. We're going to talk about Super Bowl, politics, and much else. But before we get to that, listen to this song. That's right. We celebrate Black History Month, Negro History Month, African American History Month, whichever you prefer to call it. We celebrate those who have come from the diaspora of Africa and made significant contributions not only in America but all across the world. Negro History Month began as a week. It was first celebrated on February 7th, 1926. We recognize a gentleman by the name of Dr. Carter Godwin Woodson, the father of Black history. Even before 1926, he made an appeal that Negro history should be recognized and celebrated. And in his original intent, it was not for it to be just for a month, but rather it be incorporated in education and in history. What grew from that is first a week in which the week in which we celebrate Frederick Douglass's birthday as well as Abraham Lincoln's birthday, it became Negro History Week. Then it grew to Black History Month. And because of people like Dr. Carter Godwin Woodson, we recognize people like Garrett Morgan, Mary McLeod Bethune, Sojourner Truth, Rosa Parks, Martin Luther King Jr., Malcolm X, Marcus Garvey, and so many others. Yet there is so much that is not told. People like Oprah Winfrey mentioned people like Hattie McDaniel, Recy Taylor, and so many unsung heroes like Henry Box Brown and so many others. And so the appeal and the challenge for those that celebrate Black History Month and are always amazed at things they don't know is to keep on reading, keep on studying, keep on looking. There are many things that happen during Black History Month, whether there are special presentations, often at a school or a community center. You can find a Black History Month program, and everybody wears their dashikis and their African garb, and they come out and they feel real Black for a moment. And my concern is that for some people, it's just a commercialized celebration rather than something that genuinely calls you to reflect and challenge you to be a better person. There have been many articles about the commercialization of Black History Month, and some historians' concern is that Black history should not be relegated to just one month, but it should be an ongoing process, an ongoing study, and an ongoing celebration. And so while we are grateful that there is recognition for one month, we also are very concerned that it's limited to one month. So I encourage you, wherever you live, wherever you are, to make sure that people continue to celebrate Black History Month, not just in February, but each and every day. Some funny things happen, and then some not so funny things happen. One thing that is not so funny is you often learn how much you don't know and how much your kids don't know. I'll never forget one year on Martin Luther King Day in January. A colleague of mine, their child, came to work with them. And I asked the child, why are you not in school today? And the child said, I don't know, somebody got shot. And my coworker was so embarrassed. I mean, she was beet red in the face. But the reality is her child is not the only one that doesn't know about Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and some of his significant contributions, or Ralph Abernathy, or Medgar Evers. There are many children that don't know. One Black History Month, we played a game with some young people, Name That Tune. And when we played Lift Every Voice and Sing, the song that you heard at the very beginning, when we played the original version, some kids thought that was End of the Road by Boys to Men. So we've got a lot of work to do, folks. Make sure you sit down with your child, read to them, talk to them about Black History Month and all of the significant contributions that not only those famous ancestors did, but also within your own family. I have an uncle who went to school with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., who marched, who led protests. And I try to tell my family that, you know, we have legends right here in our own bloodline. And so I encourage you to do the same. Talk about what grandma did, what grandpa did, and all the sacrifices they made and how great they were. You don't have to go far to look for history. You can look in your own family. A lot of people don't know their own family. So I encourage you, as we look at Black History Month, continue to share history, continue to be history, because history is being rewritten every day. I want to give a shout out to the Berklee College of Music. That was their rendition of Lift Every Voice and Sing. And it is a beautiful rendition. That song was originally written by James Weldon Johnson and his brother, John Rosamond Johnson. These are two young men from Florida. James Weldon Johnson was a great lawyer, and John Rosamond Johnson was an educator. And they came together. James wrote a poem one day, and they didn't have any idea this song would take off like it did. They went on to New York, or went up to the North to practice their respective vocations. And in Duval County near Jacksonville, a little school just kept singing that song, every February. And later on, some people heard the song, loved it. So it went from Florida to Georgia, and from Georgia to South Carolina, and it kept traveling. Next thing you know, the whole nation was singing that song. Lesson learned from that is you never know how much of an impact something you write will make on people's life. And although James Weldon Johnson just wrote it as a poem for a school, it ended up impacting a nation and an entire world. So be great. Don't put any limits on yourself. Don't put any limits on God, because whatever you write, whatever you say, whatever you do can end up making history and being sung or being read or being said from generation to generation. For 93 years, we have celebrated Black History Month in America. It has been a great celebration where there's been awareness, impact, change in perception and perspective. And I thank God for Dr. Carter G. Woodson and others who have fought for Black History Month, but I also wonder when will we have the same zeal and the same passion for others. I think it's not right to celebrate Black History Month and then the very next month not recognize women for Women's History Month, or in the month of May not recognize Asian Pacific Heritage Month, or in the month of November not recognize American Indian Heritage Month, or in the month of May recognize Jewish American Heritage Month. There are many people who deserve recognition, who deserve love, who deserve celebration. And one of the things that just absolutely blows my mind is, as the most growing population in America is the Latino population, the Hispanic population, when we have National Hispanic Heritage Month from September 15th to October 15th, many people are quiet as a church mouse. In fact, I asked a group of community advocates about what they do for Hispanic Heritage Month, and they all said nothing. And I just feel like if we're going to make a big deal about February, we also need to make a big deal about September and October. And so this is my appeal on this segment of the Mac Attack Show. If you want people to applaud you, you have to be willing to applaud other people. If you want people to celebrate you, you got to be willing to celebrate other people. And this is not just about holidays or birthdays. This is just about life. The Bible teaches us that in order to be a friend or to have friends, one must show themselves friendly. Likewise, if you want to be celebrated, if you want to be respected, if you want great treatment or good treatment or equal treatment or justice, treat others with the same respect. So this September, I want you to wave your flags. I want you to go to every celebration, every party. I want you to love on somebody that you may not know, that you haven't encountered before. And tell them, I appreciate you and all of your contributions to America and to this world. And I appreciate and I celebrate you and all your ancestors, not just in September, but in every time that you see a month worth celebrating or you are aware of recognition, give it to somebody. It'll bless them and it'll bless you. That's right. This is the political protest episode. And here we're going to discuss the nature of protesting, what it's done, what it has not done, and some of the local protests that have inspired this segment. I'm your host, Mac Jameson, and this is the Mac Attack Show. So in the month of February, as people have celebrated Black History Month, one of the things that are often highlighted are those civil rights advocates who fought against injustice. And it is amazing that many of those battles and those fights and those things that they fought for still exist today. And so I just wanted to lift up some of the protests that have happened recently. I'll begin with school teachers. Throughout the month of January and February, school teachers have protested because of lack of funding. They've marched. Students have actually left classrooms, walking outside of the schools with picket signs. And I think it's a sin and a shame that it has come to that point where teachers have to refuse to work in order to get paid, to receive just pay. It has often been said that teachers are some of the hardest worked individuals in the world, and yet their compensation is not reflective of it. So to all of you out there who affect pay for teachers, come on, give them a break. They've been working hard. They are practically parents for many children. Now, there are some teachers that spend more time with the kids than some parents. Sometimes they drive them home. They stay after school. They do summer school. They coach. They do so many things. And, you know, let's just try to look out for them. You know, they sacrifice so much, and they teach your kids, they love on your kids, Now, I'm not saying every teacher is exceptional, but there are some teachers that deserve much more consideration. And protesting, I want to talk about that. For many, many years, since the beginning of time, there's been injustice. And there are even incidents in the Bible, centuries upon centuries ago, where there's rebellion and revolution. What do you think causes people to get so fed up that they have to protest? What do you think happens that a person just simply gets, as Fannie Lou Hamer said, sick and tired of being sick and tired? What do you think is the motivation for somebody to say, we're going to march? Over the last few years, there have been many, many, many marches about injustice, whether it's police brutality, injustice in the courtroom, injustice in the prison system, in the political system, whether it be for rights, whether voting rights, whatever it be, may be. There are many, many protests. If you go to Greensboro, North Carolina, there's a museum dedicated to the Student Nonviolent Corps, SNCC, in which they celebrate their sit-ins and their strategies and their methodologies for protest. People have done sit-ins. People have done boycotts. Recently, we've had boycotts of Gucci, of Dove soap, of H&M clothing, and so many others. People boycott and protest often, and a lot of it is filled with emotion. But I want us to be smarter in our protest as well. Think about what we're sacrificing, how much it will impact. And you never know, sometimes the smallest protest can lead to a big march and a big movement. There's the Me Too movement, Black Lives Matter, and so many others. And so protesting is a part of life. I think it will continue to be here even long after I'm gone. But I want us to continue to fight the good fight, fight for justice, fight for what's right, fight for your children, fight for your communities, fight for your family. Continue to attack injustice, whether it be through boycotting something, marching against something, putting things out on social media against injustice. There are so many ways you can protest. So don't think all you can do is march. A lot of people are fed up with marching because we've been doing it since the early 20th century. But there are so many ways you can protest. The biggest thing is you want to hit them where it hurts. Whether it's financially or a reduction of people or whatever it may be. But when you protest, you want to do what's most impactful. So don't just automatically jump to marching. Don't just automatically jump to boycotting. Be smart, be strategic, and respect authority and leadership, but also speak truth to power. And if something is wrong, call it wrong. Now, this leads me to one of the most popular protests in the last few years. That is the kneeling by Colin Kaepernick and Eric Reid and other NFL players. This protest was to bring attention to police brutality and injustice, especially in urban communities. And a young former professional football player by the name of Colin Kaepernick, who was not the first to do it, but he's received the most attention. Colin Kaepernick was a quarterback for the San Francisco 49ers. And because of his actions, his actions for justice, which were simply during the national anthem, he would take a knee rather than stand and hold his hand on his heart. He would just take a knee. And it was not to disrespect military veterans, not to disrespect the police force or anyone else, but rather to say, until we live by those words that we are singing, I will not stand for that song. And I have to commend that. In church, if you don't believe what you're singing, don't sing. In the same way, whether it's a national anthem, in school, at a concert, if you don't believe what you're saying, you shouldn't say it. And so that's one thing I hope people take away from it. He just wanted people to be held accountable for what they're saying. So many people made his protest something else because they were convicted, they were challenged, and some people just can't admit that they're wrong. Rather than admit they're wrong and say, yeah, you know what, we need to address these things because this is terrible, they chose to make him a villain. They pretty much came together in a scheme and a plot in order for him to no longer play professional football. But what hurt many people the most was him and a former teammate, defensive player by the name of Eric Reed. They came together. They settled with the NFL. And they agreed to no longer actively protest. They agreed to no longer speak out. And the NFL compensated them in some way for their agreement. Because what happened was their movement led to other players and other teams kneeling as well. And it became such a big thing, and entire teams were coming out kneeling, and the NFL said, we can't have that. I remember going to an NFL game to see a good friend of mine, and when the national anthem played, some of the fans were so upset that they saw players kneeling. They were yelling and shouting, just leave then. If it's so terrible here, just leave. And they were booing. And it just blew my mind that people were so upset about a stance for justice that they decided to boo and hiss and defame people's character. Isn't it interesting that rather than seeking for love and the joy of all, people can take a good thing and make it a negative thing? Rather than say that's a good move that they're doing and be supportive, people would prefer to be angry. Sometimes hate doesn't know what else to do but be hateful. And so I pray that when these protests happen, for whatever comes up in the future, that people have an open heart and an open mind that maybe I need to do some self-reflection. Maybe I have been guilty of being racist. Maybe I have been prejudiced a bit. Maybe I could do better. There's no room for hate in this world. We need to do more love. We need to be more loving. And so I encourage each and every one of you, when you see a protest happening, get to the root of it, find out what's going on, and find out if it's for a good cause, find out how you can support. God bless. That's right. How can we talk about the NFL without talking about the Super Bowl? We're back. We're back live and uncut for the Super Bowl segment of the Mac Attack Show. And I'm your host, Mac Jameson. This year, while some considered it an uneventful Super Bowl, I thought it was awesome. I thought it was great. It was a great contest between the Los Angeles Rams and the now Super Bowl champions, New England Patriots. Six times. Shout out to Beantown, Mattapan, Roxbury, and all the great parts of Boston. The New England Patriots did it again. Tom Brady is considered one of the greatest of all time. And people are upset. People hate on him. But he's a winner. I don't know any other quarterback that won six Super Bowl rings. And so shout out to Bill Belichick, Tom Brady, now retired Rob Gronkowski, and everybody at the Patriots organization. But there's something else I want to lift up about the Super Bowl. While it is a great contest of the best of the NFC and the AFC, what really blows my mind is how much money is made at the Super Bowl. It is ridiculous. At the Super Bowl, let me just give you some stats. So, first of all, each player on the winning team makes an additional $112,000, while the losing team gets $56,000. The referees get about $10,000 to play in the Super Bowl, which is kind of wild. That's the low person on the totem pole, the referees. Retail stores. So it is estimated just this year in Atlanta, 14.8 billion, not million, billion dollars in sales went around the Super Bowl. That's crazy. City made that much money in the Super Bowl. The host venue gets $324 million. $324. That's almost a third of a billion. Advertisers. A lot of advertisers, they pay, I think, $5.25 million for a 30-second slot at the Super Bowl. That's $175,000 per second. Crazy, crazy, crazy. The halftime performers, they make millions of dollars. It is estimated that the Super Bowl, at the end of the day, with all of those major payouts, grosses about $3.2 billion. Billion dollars, not million. Crazy moneymaker. And that's just in legal money. Who knows how much in illegal money is made behind the Super Bowl, behind gambling and other things. It's a big business. The NFL is one of the greatest corporations in the world. People don't know it. So much money is made off of football. Some football players consider themselves the greatest entertainers in the world, and now I see why. They make so much money in football. Dangerous sport, health hazardous, but Lord knows they make a whole lot of money. So kudos to the NFL. This year they had a more difficult time finding somebody to do the halftime performance because of all of the protests, as we talked about earlier. Not only because of Colin Kaepernick and Eric Reid, but some people just protesting what some consider to be a good old boy network in the NFL. I respect that. People of integrity and of character doing what they do. But again, shout outs to the NFL for making money. If you don't do anything else right, you all know how to make money. This is Mac Jameson. It's the Mac Attack Show. And I just want to lift up. Oh, one other thing before I go. So every year when I'm watching the game, something hilarious happens. Like somebody says something that you just can't believe, or something is done, whether it's a commercial or the people I'm sitting around, something hilarious happens. So I just wanted to share some of my favorite Super Bowl memories, especially as a kid. I'll never forget one year the Raiders were in the Super Bowl, and my frat brother Jerry Porter, shout out to New Zeta, his brands were showing, and one of the gentlemen in the room saw him and said, "Man, that guy must believe in a lot of luck. Look at all those horseshoes on his arm." Now, the room was filled with college-educated men, and so everybody else busted out laughing. I felt bad for the guy because he obviously didn't know about fraternities. Obviously, he didn't go to college, but everybody else found that hilarious. But I was good with that. But the next thing he said took me out. Jerry Porter had a teammate named Napoleon Kaufman, great running back for the Raiders, and the guy saw his name. He said, "Man, I feel sorry for that guy." I said, "Why you feel sorry for him?" He said, "Because he's named after some ice cream." Totally took me out. Couldn't believe this man called him Neapolitan when his name was Napoleon. It was hilarious. And that is why I love Super Bowl parties, because it's almost guaranteed that there's going to be somebody in the room that has something extremely silly to say. And so shout out to everybody that hosts Super Bowl parties or goes to Super Bowl parties and makes them even more fun. God bless you. Cool. Well, welcome to the Mac Attack Show. This is the back to school edition. I'm your host, Mac, and I have my friend Jack on the line. I appreciate Brother Jack Monell, Mr. PhD, great scholar, great man, great husband, great father, intellectual, and an advocate for justice. He's on our show today because he is a professor at the great Winston-Salem State University. And at this time, I'm just going to ask you, Jack, just to say a few things about yourself. Like, for example, tell us where you're from.
Well, first and foremost, thanks for having me on, Mac. I'm excited to be on. I'm a native New Yorker by way of Brooklyn. And I lived in Brooklyn a long time ago, I guess way before gentrification. That's always the running joke when I talk to people about New York City today. So I was born and raised in Brooklyn, New York. And from there, I went to school in Maryland and I did all my academic stuff there, my credentialing, worked in the field a little bit. And now I call home North Carolina, here in the South, which is it's been a good place for me. It's been interesting, but it's been definitely a great place for me, a good place for my family and I.
Great. It's great to hear that you're in a great place, and I'm excited for you. And again, I'm appreciative of you. Thank you for being on the show.
This is probably one of my greatest accomplishments. And living in North Carolina, I have two sons. One is in college, one is in high school. And growing up, I didn't necessarily have my father there for me. So, one thing I vowed is that, if I was to ever get married and have a family, I would be there for them. So, one of my greatest joys has been watching my sons grow up. I'm gonna tell you though, it happens quick. Because, I remember when they were younger, but now, like I said, one plays college football, one is in high school playing football. They're both, good students because, academics for me comes first. And it's just a blessing to see them, transition from boys to adolescents and to young adults, young men.
Great stuff right there. Now that we've gotten some background information on you, I had one other question, and then we're going to get into deeper into our interview. What is your current profession, and what led you or what gave you the aspirations to seek or pursue this profession?
So people oftentimes ask me, man, I am incredibly fortunate and blessed that I'm in a career that I love. So presently, I'm a professor at the Great Winston-Salem State University, which is a historically Black university here in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Early on, I would say probably in undergrad, maybe, my major was mass communications and sociology. I studied sociology as well. And I knew I wanted to work in the field. I worked with adolescents, and I wanted to work in the criminal justice field to help, young people, people involved with the criminal justice system like I was as an adolescent. But ultimately, I knew that wasn't going to be the end of my career. I knew I wanted to be a professor, probably leading towards my senior year in undergrad and leading into my first year of graduate school in D.C. So for me, I just knew I wanted to be a professor. It's nothing more rewarding than being in a position where you can guide, convey to your students about the profession that you've enjoyed and that it's been good to you. But more importantly, you get to mentor, young men, obviously, and even the young ladies, the young women get to see, how I interact and engage with them. And more importantly, how I engage with my family, and they can see kind of, sometimes things that they don't often bear witness to in their respective environment. So it's a blessing all around, man. I truly love being a professor. I travel a lot. I conduct research, like you stated earlier in the opening, and it allows for me to conduct studies in my area of interest, which for me it's Black masculinity and popular culture, adolescence, and particularly the way people view us and why, unfortunately, we continue to see these shootings of unarmed Black males.
I'll back up on the question. You gave a great segue about criminal justice, but I'll go here before we get to that. Ever since I've known you, you've been very unique. In fact, this series is uniquely dope. You kind of had your own path, and you never really tried to follow anybody else, but be your own man and be uniquely yourself. What has been your inspirations? What are your muses? What has helped you to be comfortable in the skin you're in, and what has inspired you to be uniquely different?
You know, it's funny, right? It takes, number one, it takes maturity. I think oftentimes many of us, as we transition from college into our respective career fields, we have to find our way, right? We have to figure out what works for us. You know,
right.
I'd be remiss if, you know, initially, you know, I worked a lot. I worked in the government. So when I was working in the government in the criminal justice setting, it didn't afford me the opportunity to be who I was. And what I mean by that is, you know, I mean, I did my job quite well. You know, I served the needs of my various organization, but it wasn't necessarily who I was. And what I mean was, I've always been a strong proponent and advocate of social justice. I've always been one to speak out against injustices towards minorities, towards you know marginalized communities. And so for me, you know, as I got older and as I got more comfortable in my profession and transitioned into being a professor, it afforded me an opportunity to kind of just be more free. I mean, even as young as an adolescent, I was always kind of my own person, you know, my way. It didn't always work for me back then. But as I got older and I realized how to use those gifts, it afforded me, you know, I'm very expressionistic, as you well know. You know, I'm tatted up. I got piercings. I got the big beard. And, you know, I don't feel like you have to fit into a box to be able to reach the masses. I believe if your character, if you have strong character, and if you're sincere in your motives, people will gravitate towards you, particularly if you're trying to convey a positive message that empowers them. So for me, being who I am helps me reach my students, and it kind of eliminates those barriers that you and I so often see in our society.
Has there been any individuals or groups that you've watched or studied that has inspired you to be unique?
Well, fortunately for me, well, as a first generation college student, you know, oftentimes everything I did was through trial and error. Early on, you know, I took great, one of the first books I ever read in its entirety was obviously Malcolm X. And reading his story really inspired me to be like, you know, you can kind of be different. You can kind of make mistakes early on and still change your life. And then, of course, secondly, was, you know, the work of my fraternity, which at the time, you know, being a member of Omega Psi Phi Fraternity Incorporated, early on, I didn't realize how significant they were in the community. But as I got older and became more active and, you know, meeting brothers throughout the country, you know, I realized, wow, this is an organization of men that don't fit any one mold, in spite of maybe what the stereotypes are. You know, you got brothers from all walks of life, all backgrounds, and they're all contributing to one common goal, to better our community. And I'm going to venture to argue that's probably been my biggest inspiration to continue. They've encouraged me. All the brothers have encouraged me, you know, to tell my story, to keep doing what I do in the university setting, to keep working in the community here in Winston-Salem, and not care, you know, whomever it may make feel uncomfortable, you still work towards the ultimate goal, which is to make, you know, to bring peace to everyone, to make it equitable for everyone.
Wow. Awesome. Awesome. So you mentioned Omega Psi Phi Fraternity Incorporated, the first fraternity, African-American fraternity founded at a historically black college university. And you mentioned that you are a professor at a historically black college university. How important is that to you to be in that setting at an HBCU?
So I've had the privilege of working at a predominantly white institution as well as my current historically black college or university. I've also was educated in both. Having that early foundation academically showed me firsthand of maybe some of the experiences I was lacking and not receiving. right now, being at a historically black university is the best, and I mean the best experience I can. I mean, it's incredibly rewarding, because when you step onto that campus and you see the sea of greatness, but you see the shades of blackness, and it's just inspiring, you know, because you see these young kids, these young people, and your colleagues, and all of you guys share one commonality. And then, you know, it's so important for me. I mean, my oldest son is at an HBCU, and my even my youngest, who's in high school, is like, Dad, there's no other way for me. And that's not to discount, you know, predominantly white institutions as well. You and I equally have went to one. They serve a purpose without a doubt. Like I said, I've been shaped intellectually by both. But for me, at this stage in my life, nothing is more rewarding than being able to inspire, motivate, and mentor people that look just like you and I on a daily basis.
Cool. So, being a professor, I'm sure you experience some amazing people, and you also probably get put in some very interesting scenarios. And at the same time, higher education is changing. Students are changing. Just a lot of things are evolving. What are some of your concerns about higher education, and in particular for historically black colleges and universities?
Well, you know, very good question, right? And that's actually an incredibly hot topic right now, because historically black colleges, unfortunately, you see several that continuously close down because of varying factors. So in the state of Maryland, for example, you look at historically black colleges, they just won a lawsuit because the University of Maryland system traditionally was shortchanging them when it came down to allocating resources to their school system, you know, their university system. So one thing that's unfortunate with some of the historically black colleges is that, particularly the state-funded ones, is that oftentimes they're not equally funded comparatively to their white counterparts. So there's underfunding, which makes it difficult to basically manage your day-to-day operations. Secondly, you know, oftentimes because of that, the resources you have to provide the best and the most up-to-date resources for your student body becomes, you know, hindered. So I often find right now, as an advocate and strong proponent of HBCUs, that we got to continue to work our legislators, who ultimately decide our funding, particularly for the state schools. The private schools are much different. If I can give you one thing that I think we need, and this continues to be an incredible problem across the board, is that our alumni base is to increase alumni base support. Now, some of our institutions do better than others, but collectively, you know, when you look at a larger, you know, major division athletic school, their booster club is incredible. Their alumni base is incredible. Granted, they're incredibly large too. But, you know, with historically black colleges, that has continuously become a problem, particularly for your smaller schools, you know, who unfortunately don't have those mass alumni networks. Funding is a problem. Support. I think school spirit, we do very well with. I mean, most often than not, people love their school, but if it's not equated into dollars, it becomes hard and more difficult for schools to sustain in the 21st century when you're competing with for-profit institutions.
Wow, yeah. That's very true. So much, that was such a loaded response. I want to get a little bit more specific. Student to teacher engagement. Now with so many things on the cell phone and so many online courses, any things that concern you about the direction education is going? Like now you have a Blackboard app. You don't have to pull up your your desktop or your laptop anymore. You can do so much on the phone, and it appears that writing and even being able to articulate difficult task for the college student.
So, you know,
sir.
Hello.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Okay, I'm here. Yeah, I thought I lost you for a second.
Yeah. Oh, I'm here.
Yeah, okay, great. So, very good question. And actually, that continues to be a major problem in the school. So, where I have been concerned with student access, with the cell phones, with technology, I have worked hard to basically use it as a tool in my classroom. Is there a socialization issue with students today? Yeah, I think it is. They socialize differently. They're not like you and I, and they're not like generations prior, where, you know, we didn't have cell phones. And in the classroom setting, you engage with professors in a manner that didn't involve technology. Now, technology is a part of their fabric. And for me, I've worked hard to use it as a tool of engagement, as opposed to being a hindrance. But then to your point, I'm different. You know, I realize that that's the way they engage and communicate. So I try to use that in my classrooms when appropriate, so that I can kind of, you know, communicate with them that way. And like I said, I think for many of my colleagues, particularly the older ones, you know, they're not always as comfortable with this technology thing as I am. I'm a little bit more amenable to it. I think a lot of the old timers, they just don't flow with it. They don't, they're not willing to adapt because they just can't see how it's beneficial. But for me, I use it as a resource and tool in the classroom.
Would you be so kind as to give us an example of how you use technology, today's technology, to engage students?
Absolutely. So I'll give you several. Well, I'll give you, you know, at least two at the minimum. So for instance, in classroom settings, you know, oftentimes, you know, I teach very large classes. So, you know, I would give it a typical assignment where students have to, you know, research something. And every student has a cell phone. Every student doesn't have a laptop, you know, that, you know, because it's just not the reality of where we live in. So even if they have to look up information, or if I want them to look up an article, or if I want them to access a website, you know, and then, you know, analyze a theory, and then let's talk about the theory in class, that's how they use it. I've had students take exams in class on their phone, you know, with me proctoring, which makes it a whole lot easier to facilitate larger classrooms. And quite frankly, it helps minimize you wasting paper, you know, where, you know, in a crisis moment where, you know, you have a budgetary constraints, you know, paper is very, you know, that's a hot commodity at a university. So, you know, you save trees, as I like to say, you're saving the trees. And the students don't have to wait for me to grade their exams. If they take it online in front of me, so, you know, of course, I'm prepared, so they're not, you know, being, you know, students are, you give them an opportunity, they can take advantage. You know, I'm there proctoring, they take it and they can get their immediate results. So, you know, or even like playing, you know, various, there's numerous educational games on the collegiate level that we engage with in the classroom, like, and their phones become clickers. So, like, you know, if I want to show them, you know, latest trends, or if I want to take a survey of the class, they can use their phone as a clicker and they can see the results on my screen and see, okay, you know, 70% believe that old school hip hop is better than new school hip hop. You know, you try to engage them with things they can appreciate too, and not just make it all about, you know, the curriculum or the academic theory I'm trying to convey to them in reference.
Are you allowed to address current affairs? Like, for example, one of the hot topics right now in social justice is immigration law and the border issues in the United States. And and we have many people on one side or the other in regards to gun control. As a professor, are you allowed to speak on these matters in your classroom and in society? Is there a concern about if you speak out on certain topics, you'll lose your job? Like, how is it to be in that seat as an educator about social justice and criminal justice and having these things that you may or may not be passionate about?
So good question. The one good fortune about being, you know, a university professor is that you have a pretty decent you have intellectual academic freedom when it comes down to positions. Because I am a social justice, criminal justice professor, it is expected that I'm going to cover the issues, the very provocative issues that people oftentimes have trouble talking about. So for me, I do cover immigration. I do cover, you know, racism. I do cover, you know, gender issues. I do cover religion. I live in North Carolina. It's a strong Bible Belt state. And oftentimes we talk about religion in a manner that sometimes make people feel uncomfortable. But, you know, the reality of it is it's not rhetoric. You know, everything that I'm conveying has some sort of empirical foundation. You know, I think as an instructor, as a professor, you have an obligation to convey, you know, we convey information and we facilitate discussion. So, you know, the thing about it is you do so in a manner, you always try to be respectful of your students, you know, because you realize that all of them are not one religion over another. All of them aren't black or white. You know, even though we're a predominantly black school, we have students from other races. So you try to balance it out. You know, you try to afford everybody an opinion because you want them to debate. You want them to intellectually debate. So I'm going to tell you, I'll be frank with you. I'm not necessarily, listen, there's not, I tell people all the time, no one gets a pass in my class. We covering all these topics, but we'll do so in a manner that's a safe space to talk about it. But yeah, no, that's the one thing I don't worry about. Now, if I was in a K-12 setting, you know, the requirements are much different. You at times, you can't always have, you don't have the intellectual freedom to kind of say what you want. It's different. But at a university, you have a little bit more freedom to be able to cover those tough topics that, like I said, you can't always talk about sometimes in the high schools or the middle schools.
Right. So, time will not permit us to deal with all of the major issues. One I'm passionate about is gun control. Time magazine recently came out, and on the front cover, it has all of these cities where there have been a massive amount of shootings. And I look in the upper left corner, and I see my hometown, Petersburg, Virginia.
Wow.
It infuriated me. And as I was talking to some colleagues and friends about it, their immediate response was, well, remember the 80s? You know, it was worse. And I hear people say that a lot. And I guess they're comparing now to the crack epidemic, and people feel like there were many more shootings back then. But based on your knowledge, and you probably have statistical data to support it, have things gotten better or have things gotten worse?
So when we look at violent crime, very good question. Very good question. Not only do they like to go to the 80s or the crack epidemic, they like to always use Chicago and some of the more predominantly black concentrated areas of urban America.
Right. Chicago, exactly. St. Louis.
Exactly. So when we look at violent crime, right? So up until recently, and quite surprisingly, violent crime was going down. You had a 20-year downturn of violent crimes. What has increased is mass shootings. Mass shootings has increased exponentially. The problem, which they don't want to address, is that mass shootings specifically, I'm not talking about serial killers or nothing like that. That's a different crime typology. When we talk about mass shooters, they are predominantly white. There's no denying that. So when shooters predominantly white, it's a mental health issue. But when the shooter right. is black, it's criminalized. And that has historically wow. always been the issue in our country. So when we look at gun control that you so well are passionate, I'm equally passionate about. I have sons, I worry about it. I worry about myself, I worry about my colleagues. You know, I worry about my wife, who she's an administrator at a school. And where do mass shootings sometimes often occur? In the schools. So, you know, for me, when we look at, you know, when we talk about gun control and gun rights, you know, you remember during 1994, they passed a ban on assault weapons. Well, guess what? Mass shootings went, you didn't hear about mass shootings for like a 10-year period. Once it right. expired under the Bush administration, once it expired, then you started seeing a slow increase in mass shootings. Yeah. You start seeing, you know, all these individuals start increasing and increasing and increasing exponentially. You know, so yeah, people are going to say, well, you know, assault rifles aren't the only things they use. No, they're absolutely right. That's not the only weapon used to conduct, carry out these horrific events in our society. But the reality of it is, you know, another adage or another way they convey it, or, well, you know, guns don't kill people, people kill people. Yeah, I get it. But the gun is the vehicle, you know. So if we had, you know, people who had devious motives and they didn't have access to a gun, then guess what? There wouldn't be no mass shootings. So, you know, I'm a proponent of the Second Amendment. I believe, you know, one should be able to protect their home and their person, of course. You know, I support that. But I also realize that people misconstrue the Second Amendment. I don't see the value in having an assault rifle to hunt. I mean, hunt is a skill. I don't see why you need, you know, a high caliber, you know, assault rifle to hunt. You know, I don't see why everybody needs to have one in their house unless they're stockpiling for some sort of pending war.
Right.
So, you know, that's my issue with this. And, you know, once again, I'm in a very, very pro-gun state. And it's very concerning because, you know, people don't know how to resolve conflict anymore. Or let me rephrase. People don't want to resolve conflict. If you don't like me, if I'm angry at you or if I hate you, guess what? I'm going to go to my gun. I'm going to shoot you. And then that's the easy result. And then because of privilege, you're afforded the opportunity of not being labeled a hate, a white nationalist or something. And I'll give you an example real quick. So 2 weeks ago, we had a horrible shooting where a local black barber was killed by the name of Julius Sampson Jr., who was coming to the defense of a bartender at an establishment he was at with another barber. There was a group of white guys who were ultimately calling, you know, spewing the N-word to folks. And they basically said, yo, y'all need to cut that stuff out. He and the individual, you know, they exchange words. They go outside and scrap. And then ultimately the white guy ends up shooting him and killing him. Well, as of early as yesterday, the chief of police, who happens to be an African-American female, says, well, you know, our investigators have determined that this wasn't a hate crime. And I'm just thinking to myself, how in the world is this not a hate crime? And then, you know, you look on this guy's social media page and you look at other things, he's displaying the white nationalist signs and things of that nature. So, you know, we have a big problem in our society where, you know, there's a sense of empowerment and entitlement for people, particularly white nationalists. And unless we address that, because this is a new, let me rephrase, this isn't a new phenomenon. It's been like that since slavery.
Right.
But the reality of it is, it's gotten to a point now that they have been, you know, empowered to really, really carry out horrific events and claim mental illness or claim, you know, white superiority as a defense.
Wow. So, you said a lot. Now I'll address one thing. So my issue with guns personally, this is just me. I don't ask anybody to agree with it. I cannot think of any other instrument or tool on this planet that has one sole purpose, and that is destruction. If you look at a knife, you can use it for cooking. If you look at other things, they have multiple uses. But a gun has one sole function, and that is to destroy. And so for me, while I respect the Second Amendment, I respect it totally, I just believe that if we were in a world where there were no guns, the world would be a safer place. And I know some people say that will never happen. I know I'm an idealist, but I just really wish we got to a place where people could resolve issues without going to a gun. As far as hunters, I fully respect that. Hey, that's your thing. If that's what you do to kick back, I respect that. But for me, ideally, those SKSs, those AK-47s, all these other weapons that, like you said, they don't really need, can we do it without those? Because like you said, the mass shootings, when they typically happen, it's not a 22, it's not a Ruger, it's not a Glock, it's an assault rifle. And so I just wish somebody would look at this and say we need to stop. But the reality is, and this goes to a whole nother dialogue, there's so much money involved in the big business of guns. And we can go as far back as the Iran-Contra controversy back in the 80s and how drugs were flooded into African-American communities by way of selling guns. And so it's so many layers to this whole gun thing. And I'll be honest with you, I'm just concerned that they'll never go away. And for some people, it's because of power. It's been guns that have been used since colonization to overtake communities. When people look at Africa and the great empires that happened, I remember some young people asked me, so what happened? How, if you had all these kings and queens and these great builders, how did they lose it? And I said, it was guns. They went to fight the European colonists and they did not have guns. And so for me, guns are just a massive source of destruction. During the Reconstruction, once slavery was quote unquote abolished, gun sales in Mississippi and Alabama skyrocketed because in these states, descendants of Europe or descendants of the Caucasus Mountains, whatever you prefer to call them, they were outnumbered by black people. And so the only way they could ensure their safety, their power, their authority was they got more guns. And so for me, that is just guns are a recipe for disaster. But I would at least like for legislators to entertain getting rid of the assault rifles. To me, that is a great step in the right direction.
No, I totally agree. And you know, the irony is, let me preface that by saying, I don't hunt. That's not my thing. I think I went when I was 12 and, you know, it was cool, you know, but, you know, my thing is, I guess I don't gain any joy in hunting something that can't hunt you back, I guess. That's my weird street kind of ideology. But, you know, I used to be an idealist, right? I'm more cynical now, but I'm an optimist. With a little bit of skepticism, right? I have to believe that things will get better. Sometimes concerned, are they going to get better during my lifetime or not? You know, but guns right now is the last thing that the dwindling dominant culture, which at this instance is white, is the white culture that's dwindling in the United States particularly, that's the only thing they have left that they feel will keep them in power. And right. Oftentimes I joke that if all black folks or Latinos or whoever feels like they're a part of the movement, if everybody got a weapon and got certified, all that jazz, you would find they would pass gun laws. They would change the gun laws tomorrow. I promise right. you they would, dude. I promise you. Like for real. Like, you know, you don't need to be a scientist to figure that out. You don't have to be a scientist to figure that out. Exactly.
Ronald Reagan.
You saw it with the black
laws in California. Because the Black Panthers showed up. So
exactly.
Absolutely. So I want to. So I want to switch gears a little bit as we're winding down. Often art imitates life. And there have been several movies this year within the last year that have had tremendous impact, I believe, on society. I believe one is 7 Seconds. Another is When They See Us. And then recently, Free Meek Mill. What role do these documentaries that show the injustices in society, particularly towards Black and brown people, what role do you think these movies play in creating awareness? And do you believe or feel that it's not enough, or these are great step in the right direction, or are they not even fully telling the true story of what's going on?
So, quite frankly, about 5 years ago, Ken Burns came out with a documentary about the Central Park Five. It wasn't mainstream media. I mean, you kind of had to know about it. I knew about it because, you know, as we talked about earlier, you know, I was a juvenile delinquent. You know, I was involved in the juvenile justice system. I knew the Central Park Five. So I've always followed their story. So I knew about it. So I introduced my classrooms to it years ago, before When They See Us. When They See Us, the Meek Mill one, 7 Seconds, all of these documentaries, particularly because of their platforms, their streaming platforms, because of that, they do not only reach people within the country, they reach the world. So then the world becomes aware of the injustices that these individuals face during their ordeal. So that's the first step to answer your first question. Incredibly important, right? That's where how you use communication, you know, you use the media in the positive. Now, what do we do from here is that's the second part of this.
Right.
Information with awareness comes action. So what do we do now? So in the instances of Meek Mill, you know, he's very active in trying to work towards criminal justice reform and working obviously with Roc Nation and Jay-Z, you know, and that conglomerate trying to address criminal justice reform. The Exonerated Five, you know, specifically Yusef Salaam, he's working towards bringing awareness not only to what occurred to them, but, you know, trying to address the wrongfully convicted. So, you know, and then lastly, what we want to see is legislative changes. So it's like a three-step approach. It's like a three-prong approach to addressing these injustices, varying injustices, though they're similar in instances. So, you know, the documentaries provide information, they provide awareness, the individuals themselves or their supporting parties provide the activism, you know, as far as pushing the agenda, and then finally, legislative action, changing the laws that are creating these barriers or promoting these behaviors that are incarcerating Black and brown people. Case in point, you can't lock up a generation of African-American and Latino males for marijuana selling, but then have white conglomerates open up dispensaries and call it legal. It's hypocrisy at its best. Just one is selling weed on a corner, and now one has a fancy, fluffy little building and they're selling weed out of there in various edibles or however they sell it. You can't do that. You can't keep people incarcerated for selling marijuana in the 80s when you have white businesses now profiting and making millions while by selling marijuana today.
Right. 100% agree with you. So as a pastor, this is a very hot topic amongst some of my colleagues, and the question comes, what is our position? And for me, what's most important is, while I want people to be influenced by the Holy Spirit, I want that to be the primary influence. For me, I have to address the justice issue. And as you stated, if young people or old people, whomever, have been incarcerated, and when compared to our counterparts, the things don't even add up, whether it be the amount or the charges of distribution or possession. when people are being incarcerated for such long terms while this is becoming big events. This is big business. People are, as you said, opening up dispensaries, creating farms just to grow cannabis and hemp and all of these things. It's just problematic for me. And for me, community leaders and advocates, we have to have the relationships with our delegates, our senators, our congresspeople, and whomever to say, hey, this is not right. And we need some change. We need some equality. And that's, to me, what's most important. We need you to give these people their rights back, their freedom back. And that includes all of the challenges people face when they get out of jail. We need to remove all of those things. And that's a whole nother topic. People can't even live with their families because they have a record. They can't move in the same apartment or same house. They can't get jobs. So many things have happened in addition to the trauma that they've dealt with, and they need trauma-informed care. It's just so many layers behind this. And for me, as an advocate and a person who cares for people, we want justice. That's what's most important. And you're right. So for me, after watching these movies, my question is, well, what can I do? What are the next steps for me? What do I need to learn? Because I'm a firm believer when laws are put in place, there's a 20-year plan. And if you come and respond now, there's already been some wheels put in motion that people are way ahead of you at. And so for me, I want to know, what can we do now? How can we change the direction that these wheels are going? And what can we do to not only affect legislation, but also for our communities to be self-sufficient? I believe when we have our own businesses, we do our own things, and we're not dependent upon other people and their laws and their system, we can be just fine.
You know, and I know we're pretty much, you know, finishing up. I work collaboratively with the Ministers Conference here in Winston-Salem, who is a big, they're a pretty strong social justice entity here in the city of Winston-Salem. And, you know, I always tell, you know, pastors and religious leaders of all faiths, you know, you guys have an incredible platform. And you know, I know the charge is to ensure that your congregation is doing well and doing the Lord's work, you know, whomever is your deity. But I always encourage, you know, religious leaders, just use your platform for good, man. Don't sell out your pulpit. And what we're seeing today, man, sadly, and this is definitely for another topic, is how, you know, our religious leaders, for the purposes of political preferences, state, local, and federal, you know, local, state, and federal, is compromising their integrity, knowing that what they're seeing is not righteous, man. And I think that hurts me, because in the end, it hurts our community, man. So for you, you know, I've always respected you from day one, especially when you went on this journey, you know, and I'm proud of that work you're doing. I just, you know, I keep encouraging that, you know, keep doing, you know, keep fighting the fight, brother, man, keep doing it. You know, I'm listening, many of us are listening. And then keep your colleagues, you know, your religious colleagues, keep the pressure on, you know, because I know it ain't easy, man. I know it ain't easy. But I appreciate the work you're doing, even in this venue, you know, using this aspect of engagement and interaction to reach the masses is another aspect of how we, in the 21st century, we invoke kind of this extra tool and you extend your pulpit of sorts to reach people in other states and other countries. And so, you know, wherever it may be.
Oh, thank you, my brother. That means a lot, and I appreciate you as well. And I've been watching and very proud of all that you do. And I just have one last question, then we're going to depart. And that is, as an educator, do you have any words of advice for any college student listening in, or any parent of a college student that they can, some tools that they can use for success going into 2019, 2020?
Absolutely. So for the class of 2023, incoming freshmen, I strongly encourage you guys to where you'll be excited, anxious, a little bit homesick and overwhelmed. Whenever you get onto that college campus, work with your RAs, figure out who your professors are, get to know your professors, get to know your environment, you know, and just use your enthusiasm, use your youthful enthusiasm to engage with their campus community, wherever that may be, and identify, you know, develop good habits early on, because it's easy for us, believe me, I had some bad habits in college too, you know, develop some good habits and realize that you're not alone in this fight, and 4 years will go fast. Parents, your kids are going to be okay. Let them go out there, spread their wings, provide them support. I have a college kid too. I know my wife was in tears when we dropped them off last year. Just realize that they're in the best place they can be to grow, and let them grow and support them when they need to be supported. And I'm sure and I'm confident in 4 years you'll be crying again when they cross that stage.
Amen. Thank you. This is Jack Monell, social justice advocate extraordinaire, college professor, husband, father, brother of the greatest fraternity in the world, Omega Psi Phi Fraternity Incorporated. My friend, my brother, thank you. We appreciate you, man. Thank you again. God bless.
God bless, brother. Peace and blessings, man. Take care.